your Radio Hall of Fame. Yes, this is your Radio Hall of Fame, where, in the belief that superlative performance in the field of entertainment deserves high honor, the Philco Corporation brings you each week the stars made great by your recognition of their achievements. Philco is assisted in discovering the public's choice by the editors of that authority on audience opinion, the famous weekly of show business, Variety. Tonight, waiting to be installed in your Radio Hall of Fame are America's foremost rhythm trio, the Andrews Sisters, a great comedian, Ed Wynn, who will introduce a surprise guest of his own, a radio adaptation of the picture of the year, Darrell F. Zanuck's Wilson, with Alexander Knox and Geraldine Fitzgerald. And, of course, your Radio Hall of Fame's permanent musical director, the Dean of Modern American Music, Paul Whiteman. And finally, our guest master of ceremonies for this season's first program is a personality who long ago was nominated by you for the Hall of Fame. For it was your votes which helped him win more popularity polls than any other sports announcer. And after 20 years of sterling performances, in spite of his comparative youth, he is now the grand old man of sportscasters. By this time, you must have guessed who we mean, Ted Husing.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Glenn Riggs. Oh, this is great. For a performer to appear on the Radio Hall of Fame is like a ball player getting into the World Series. It's really definitely the top. And speaking of the World Series, we begin this evening's festivities by presenting three girls who, like the St. Louis Browns, who won the American League pennant today, have a terrific batting average in the league of popularity. 7 years ago, they took a little thing called Bimir Bis Duchesne. They walloped it for a homer or clear across the country. And they've been walloping homers with other songs ever since. In a recent GI poll, they were voted America's most popular musical group. They've sold more than 30 million records. And because of these accomplishments, you, Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Public and family, have unlocked the doors of the Radio Hall of Fame to America's number one rhythm trio. Here they are, the Andrews Sisters. Well, gals, what's it going to be?
The tune that's outselling all the others on records today. It's hotter than the Browns and the Tigers. Is You Is or Is You Ain't My Baby. I've got a guy who's always late. Anytime we have a date, but I love him. Yes, I love him. He's gonna walk up to my gate. And see if he can get it straight, 'cause he wants her. He's gonna ask her. Is you is or is you ain't my baby. The way you're acting lately makes me doubt. Baby, seems my flame in your heart's done gone out. A woman is a creature that has always been strange. Just when you're sure of one, you find she's gone and made a change. Is you is or is you ain't my baby. Maybe baby's found somebody new. Or is my baby still my baby true? Is you or is you ain't my baby, 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 boy, the way you're acting lately makes me doubt. You is still my baby, 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 boy, it seems my flame in your heart's done gone out. Is a creature that has always been strange. Just when you're sure of one, you find she's gone and made a change. Is you is or is you ain't my baby. Maybe baby's found somebody new.
the days of peacetime production before the war, a single phrase expressed the tradition which Philco had built up over the years. Famous for quality the world over. Those words summed up the reputation that had made Philco the industry leader for 12 straight years, the world's largest radio manufacturer. Today, that reputation for quality has spread to our fighting forces on worldwide battlefronts. Philco Research and Philco Quality Manufacture are contributing their proper share to the miraculous functions which radio and electronic equipment are performing for war. As you think of the future, you have a right to expect new developments in radio and phonograph entertainment. And you can look to Philco leadership in radio research and engineering to bring them to you in the Philco tradition, famous for quality the world over.
If anybody is deserving of your interest and favor, and therefore a place in your Radio Hall of Fame, it's Paul Whiteman. For more years than I have hairs, to you good people, Paul Whiteman has meant fine music played in a big-time manner. More important performers and musicians have received their start with Paul Whiteman than with any band leader in the business. Oh, there are plenty of reasons for his being on the Radio Hall of Fame. Come on in here, Pappy, and take a bow while somebody out here raises a sign saying applause.
Thanks for them pleasant words, Ted.
Oh, that's okay, Pappy. After all, I got my first big break with you two on the old Gold Show just 15 years ago.
Ted, my lad, you really, really take me back.
Those were the days, Pappy. Say, do you think I've changed much since then?
Nope, you're pretty much the same, Ted. You're still the only guy I know whose scalp has middle-aged spread.
Oh.
You think I've changed much?
No, you still look like we the people with legs. Tell me, what's it going to be, Pappy?
A sentimental old favorite with a streamlined treatment. Avalon.
Well. Beautiful, Paul, beautiful. You know, I hate to sound like a Nicky, but I still like the way you played it 15 years ago when we were on the same show.
You mean when we hung the derby on the trombone and put the axe of grease on the old slide whistle?
Exactly what I mean.
Well, Ted, my boy, you asked for it and you got it. Boys, kick it off. Kick it off.
Reaching into the past brings other memories than Avalon scored for the slide whistle. When back in April 26, 1932, a giggling voice said, "Tonight the program's going to be different, Graham," this marked the radio appearance of a great stage comedian who, in the character of the fire chief, was to become the most popular figure of his time on the airwaves, thus securing him a permanent place as a radio immortal. I refer, of course, to the one and only Ed Wynn. When news broke that after a lapse of 7 years, Ed Wynn was returning to the air in his own program for Borden's as King Bubbles of mythical Happy Island, although it did knock the war off the front pages, millions of Ed Wynn fans were delighted. And we're delighted to have him with us tonight. The man who is responsible for studio audiences, Ed Wynn.
Hello, everybody. Thank you. You see, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be here. The devil is in me tonight, though. You'll find that out.
Say, welcome to the Hall of Fame, Ed.
Oh, thank you, Ted. It's last time in the Hall of Fame. Isn't that wonderful? Are there any other great and famous people, I mean, besides me here?
Well, besides what we've already had, Ed, we're going to do a dramatization of Wilson.
Wilson?
Yes, you remember Wilson. Wilson is the man who became famous for originating the 14 points.
Oh, today that wouldn't get him a quarter pound of butter. Times have changed now.
Say, Ed, I want you to meet the other people on our show.
Uh-huh.
This is Paul Whiteman, our musical director.
Oh. How do you do, Ed?
Hello. You wanted me to meet the other people on the show? Hello, Paul. You know, Paul, my whole family was musical. My brother used to play one of those big violins. What do you call those, there, Paul?
Oh, you mean the bass viol.
A bass viol. My brother played a bass viol for 8 years, but the family made him give it up because it hurt him socially. Whenever he asked a young lady to dance, you know, just from force of habit of playing that instrument, he'd grab her around the neck with one hand and beat her on the back with the other, you know? Oh, my goodness. There is a thing I don't know about music, you know.
Well, I have my doubts about that.
You have? Well, ask me any question you want. Any question.
All right. What's the difference in the contrapuntal technique employed by Shostakovich in his Allegro con moto as opposed to the largo motivation in the fugues by Bach?
No coaching from the audience.
Now, just... You see, you know nothing about music.
Yeah, well, it's only an hour show, you know. I can't...
Well, I consider myself a pretty good judge.
Oh, you're an authority on music.
That's right, a very good judge.
Oh, well, I'd like to try you if you think you know so much about music. Somebody hand me a violin. Anybody. Oh, thank you. Here. You know so much about... Here. Did you hear that note?
Yeah.
You know so much about music. What opera is that note from? I guess that settles in. Just one of those... Musical ignoramuses.
Ed, pardon me for interrupting, but we want to strike a serious note for a minute. We have a special guest tonight, and I think you are just the right man to introduce him.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll just permit me to drop my comic mask for the moment, this is a great pleasure. I'd like to appear before you as a human being. Now, recently as part of only the second USO unit to ever visit that part of the globe, Our next guest went into the China-Burma-India Theater of Warfare, where I understand he really received a great reception, and I'm not surprised. Because if I were asked why he should be in the Hall of Fame, I'd say that he's probably the fastest up-and-coming young comedian in the movies. And I personally think he proved that in See Here, Private Hargrove, in which he didn't have the title role, but got more attention from the critics than anyone else in the picture. In addition, I think he's also the most versatile young comedian in pictures. And those are the reasons I think that this young man should be in the Hall of Fame. Those are the only reasons. And not because he happens to be my son. Keelan Wynn. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Keenan is not in New York, so we're going to try to contact him in California.
Hello, Dad.
Oh, hello, Dad, he said. Oh, there he is. Hello, son. I miss you, son.
Oh, I miss you. I miss you, Dad.
Oh, I miss you very much, son.
Well, I miss you very much, Dad.
Now I know how Judge Hardy felt when Mickey Rooney was drafted. Getting very sad. I want you to know, Keenan, that I'm very proud of you, my little baby boy.
Dad.
Yeah?
I've got news for you.
Yeah?
I'm no longer a little baby.
Yes, you are.
Oh, no, I'm not. Since those days, I've added 25 years to my age.
That's funny. I've only added 10 to mine.
No, look, Pop.
Yeah?
I hate to disillusion you, but I'm a man.
You're a man. Well, you always wanted to get old quick. Even when you were a few months old, you were the only kid I ever saw who wore a dighty with a belt in the back.
I remember.
Always wanted to be old, you know.
Well, I guess I must have given you a lot of trouble when I was young.
I'll say you did, son. Do you remember the time I caught you on the street corner whistling at the girls and I chased you away?
Yeah. How was I to know it was your corner?
Hey, maybe he has grown up. I didn't realize that. You were really a problem, though, son. Really, you were.
It was your own fault. Kind of education you gave me.
Why, there was no kid who knew as much as you. 2 years at Smith, 2 years at Vassar, 2 years at Wellesley.
Say, Pop, those are all girls' schools, you know.
There was no kid who knew as much as you did.
Well, those days are gone. I'm an old married man now.
I can't believe you're married, Keenan. I can't believe you're married. I just cannot believe you're married.
Say, Pop, you sound like a house detective.
Why crack that? My baby boy is married.
Yes, your baby boy is married, and your baby boy has a baby boy of his own. Little Edmund Wynn.
What?
And another baby on the way.
You mean your wife's going to still have another baby?
Uh-huh.
For heaven's sake. What did you do, get Crosby, Stalk, or Lend-Lease out there?
Well,
you're
going to
make me a double grandfather?
Yes, you're a grandfather.
You rat. I'm a grandfather. Well, I don't feel like a grandfather. I don't feel like a father. I feel young. I'm going out with girls to dance all through the hours. I'm having myself a mad gay time, Keenan.
Pop.
Yes?
Does your vitamin pill taste different lately?
Now I'm getting to resent my own son. There's not enough room in this family for two comedians, you know, Keenan.
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, I'm talking about you. Why don't you go into some other line of business?
Well, I can't. I work in Hollywood.
I know that.
You know what the principal industry in Hollywood is, don't you?
Sure, I know what the industry is in Hollywood. Fighting. But I'm not really jealous, Keenan. I have my own life. I'm married to my joke.
You're married to your joke?
Yes.
It'll never be a successful marriage.
Why not, Keenan?
The wife is older than the husband.
Are you sure you wouldn't be happy running a gas station or something, Keenan? I don't like you in the same business that I'm in, you know.
No, Pop, I'm doing too well in Hollywood.
Well, I guess you're really a success. Right now, I think you're a bigger star than I am, Keenan.
Oh, no, no, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, no, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Well, if you say so, Pop. For
heaven's sakes, you didn't have to give in that easy, did you? You sure wouldn't... Listen, would you like to sell insurance, Keenan? I think it's better than trying to be a comedian.
No, no, I'm happy at Hollywood.
Well, you're certainly making out pretty well.
Well, you wanted me to make good, didn't you?
Oh, yes, but there's such a thing as overdoing it, you know. Hollywood, though, I remember when I was working there, Keenan.
Oh, well, things have changed, Pop.
Have they?
Yeah, they're making pictures with sound now.
I'm sure he's a rat, you know. There's no getting away from it. I wonder whether a father can force a son to open a candy store. I'd just like to see him out of the theater. Say, Keenan, since you're a big shot out in Hollywood, I guess you know all the stars.
Oh, some.
I'd like to ask you about a Satan star out there.
Well, which one?
Oh, I don't know. You think I'm silly.
No, no, I won't.
I don't know whether I should really ask.
Oh, go ahead. What is it?
Well, listen. Do you know Frank Sinatra? Huh?
Of course I know Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
Why, the last time I saw Frankie, he took me to breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Oh, you poor kid.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, you're being fed by a tube. That's terrible. Listen, tell me, what else is new out there in Hollywood, Keenan?
Well, Dorothy L'Amour is married.
That's too bad, really.
What's the difference? You didn't stand a chance with Dorothy when she was single.
I know. I can't fire a gun either, but I'm sorry when the hunting season is over. You can't go by that.
Well, Dad, I hope New York agrees with you.
Oh, I love it here, son. I know everybody in town, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know Mayor LaGuardia?
Do I know Mayor LaGuardia? What a silly question. Every time I pass the mayor on the street, I tip my hat. And the mayor's hat tips him. Oh, man, for heaven's sake.
Before I go, Dad.
What?
What else is new?
Well, did you know I've got the most popular radio program on the air of my own?
The most popular radio program on the air?
Well, I wouldn't exactly say it's the most popular, no, but it's among the first 10.
The first 10?
What's the matter with that guy? Well, the first 10 on Friday nights, anyhow. I've got the biggest listening audience of any comedy show.
The biggest listening audience of any comedy show.
Well, not exactly the biggest. No, I don't want to lie to you. You're my son, but we get more laughs than any other show.
You get more laughs than any other show?
Well, any show like Inner Sanctum, yes, yes. And besides that, Keenan, the sponsor has given me a contract for 5 years.
5 years?
Well, it's really 3 years there, Keenan.
3 years?
Well, not exactly 3 years, no. It's for 2 years with monthly options.
Monthly options?
What?
Monthly options, eh?
Well, I'm on next week. You can't talk me out of that anyhow. Well, so long, son.
So long, Dad.
Goodbye.
Thank you, Keenan. Thank you, Ed. We'll be seeing you, Keenan, not next week, but soon, in the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer production of Marriage is a Private Affair. And now, Glenn Riggs for Philco.
Wartime living has brought home to America the many advantages of frozen foods and frozen storage. For years before the war, Philco refrigeration engineers saw frozen foods coming. With foresight and courage, they were the first to introduce a complete line of refrigerators with a full-size, separate, completely enclosed compartment specially designed for frozen storage. So, after victory, when refrigerators appear again on your dealer's floor, Philco will speak with authority and experience. In the Philco refrigerator, you will get frozen storage facilities that are tested by years of actual use and backed by years of pioneering research. And, in addition, you'll get value, a maximum of service and quality for the price you pay.
Your Radio Hall of Fame will continue after station identification. This is the Blue Network. Every once in a while, a picture comes along that has the stamp of greatness on it. According to Variety's reflection of your judgment, the picture of the year bids fair to be 20th Century Fox's Technicolor production of Darrell F. Zanuck's Wilson. Tonight from Hollywood, Wilson appears in adaptation on your Radio Hall of Fame because those of you who have seen Wilson have founded a contribution in which a fascinating segment of American history is combined with the first-rate entertainment. Because you recognize in Wilson the Sega of an American president whose World War I problems seem so sharply echoed in our times. And because a virtual unknown, Alexander Knox, playing the role of Wilson, catches with almost uncanny accuracy the spirit of the man he portrays. In addition to Alexander Knox, Geraldine Fitzgerald will also appear in our radio adaptation, playing her original role of Edith Galt. The musical background for Wilson will be furnished by the 20th Century Fox Orchestra under the direction of Alfred Newman, who scored the picture. And now, Wilson. The year is 1909. The 20th century is very young. These are pleasant, quiet, happy days. Big Bill Taft in the White House, Teddy Roosevelt in Africa hunting lions. The crowds in the ballpark cheering Ty Cobb. 1909. Old Jim Jeffries planning a comeback fight to take the heavyweight belt from Jack Johnson. Barney Oldfield still racing his car to new records, almost 60 miles an hour. The Wright brothers up in their flying machine and people still saying it just can't be done. 1909. Young lovers singing the new hit tune and holding hands in the newfangled Nickelodeons while watching The Perils of Pauline. 1909. A world at peace, and still men are marching, though not to war. The annual Yale-Princeton football game, and in the Princeton stands, one voice rising above all the rest.
Fight!
Mark that voice. Mark that man. A slim man, almost frail, but there's a stubborn cut to the slant of his jaw.
No, not so loud.
Father, you're poking that boy with your cane.
A serious man, a sober man, but at home with his family after the game. A dignified man, a college professor, but not above trying a soft shoe dance.
Woodrow, I really think you're improving.
This is the man. Out of all the millions in his time, destiny will beckon to this one man. Destiny and the person of Senator Big Ed Jones, political boss of the state of New Jersey.
Mr. Wilson, how would you like to be governor of New Jersey?
Governor?
There's a strong progressive movement running in this country. People are looking for a change.
Yes, why me? I'm not a politician.
No, but this fight you've been putting up at Princeton.
You know, democracy against special privilege. That's got a lot of people talking.
Well, then you must know the saying, I'm a notorious and incurable reformer.
Oh, we got nothing against reformers, long as they're on our side.
Frankly, gentlemen, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. Remember, I'm a school teacher, which must make me something of an idiot in the eyes of a lot of good people. I've never even been in the State House. And until this moment, my political influence has been exactly one vote. What's even worse, I'm a Southern Democrat in a Yankee stronghold.
Well, we just won't tell anybody about that.
And you will think it over, Professor.
Oh, I'll do better than that, Senator. I'll have my wife think it over.
Woodrow, I know you haven't any personal ambition just to hold office, but you must admit the opportunity is rather unusual.
I know, Ellen, but we mustn't be too hasty. As Mr. Dooley says, any Democrat with a steady job had better stick to it. Besides, I've certain responsibilities to Princeton.
Your work at Princeton is done, and you know it. If your ideas about democracy are right, they'll prevail one of these days, whether you're here or not. And if they are worthwhile, don't they apply to all the people, not just Princeton?
It would mean the end of the kind of life we've known.
Yes.
I'd never write that great book I've been talking about all my life. There'd be no more holidays.
Holidays aren't everything.
I declare, Ellen, I never met such an ambitious woman in my life. But I warn you, if I do go into this, mind you, I'm not saying I will. You're the one who'll have to kiss all the babies. That's one thing I absolutely draw the line at.
faster.
Professor Holmes, it's his first big political rally. Do you really think they'll like him?
Stop worrying, Ellen. Of course they will.
But Woodrow's had no experience with people like these.
No, and they've had no experience with a man like him. Steady now, he's going to start.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Many of my friends are worried about this campaign. They tell me I'm conducting it in the worst possible way because, it appears, I'm asking you to think. On the other hand, my opponents are even more worried because they expected my speeches to be mere academic lectures on government. Apparently, they've deluded themselves into thinking I've had no political experience. No political experience. Good heavens. I wonder if these gentlemen have ever attended a faculty meeting or seen the wives of the trustees in action.
That's all very amusing, Mr. Milton. But why don't you tell us what kind of a deal you've made with the bosses?
Get back up. Mr. Holmes, who is that?
Joe Tummel, the young Irish lawyer in the legislature. Quite a liberal, I think.
Well, Mr. Wilson, do I get an answer?
I've made no deal with anyone.
And I suppose you'll deny there's even such a thing as a boss system in New Jersey.
The existence of the boss system is notorious.
Then what are you going to do about it?
Spend all my energies to breaking it up.
He's
when you say bosses, you mean Big Ed Jones?
Of course I mean Big Ed. I feel about him exactly as I feel about every other boss, Democrat or Republican. Senator Jones understands exactly how I feel. In fact, he's given me his word that in no circumstances will he stand for re-election to the United States Senate, an office for which I consider him utterly unfitted.
What do you say, Big Ed?
I say the candidate speaks for the party.
Professor Holmes, wasn't he wonderful?
Ellen, your husband just made the most idiotic campaign speech in the history of politics.
I don't understand.
He means what he says.
The rest is history, for he does mean what he says, and the first one to discover it is Big Ed Jones. Newspapers everywhere carry the story. Governor Wilson of New Jersey kicks out the bosses who put him in office. And people everywhere are starting to talk. Here is a man who speaks the truth. Here is a man who should go far. But where does Professor Holmes find him now, this man whom destiny has touched? Well, now he's just one of the crowd again at the Palace Theater in New York, listening to Eddie Ford.
Mr. Governor, Ellen.
Mr. Holmes.
Official business, no doubt.
It's odd. It seems something important like this comes up every time the program changes.
Well, they tell me you've been taking to politics like a billy goat to tin cans, raising cane all over the place. No wonder they want to get you off their hands. Kick you upstairs into the White House.
Oh, you don't want to take those Wilson for President clubs too seriously. Remember, a lot of people still think I'm a pretty dangerous fellow.
And so you are, but it's too late now. I've planked out $5 myself to help bamboozle the public.
Just throwing it away.
Maybe. But then Teddy Roosevelt's a Harvard man, and Bill Taft's from Yale. And I'd give $5 of my money any day to get a Princeton boy a crack at both those outfits in one game.
That fearless leader who has never sold
convention underway, the nominations being made.
It is my great honor and distinguished privilege to place in nomination for the exalted office of President of the United States that great statesman from Alabama, Oscar W. Underwood.
I give you that great statesman from Missouri, that great servant of the common man, the Honorable Jeff Fort. New Jersey appreciates the honor of placing before this convention as a candidate for the presidency of the United States, the seer and philosopher of Princeton, the Princeton schoolmaster, Woodrow Wilson.
The 46th ballot, Woodrow Wilson, Democratic nominee. Weeks of campaigning while the cheers and shouting reach their frenzied peak. And finally, on a memorable night in November.
Woodrow, Taft and Roosevelt have conceded. You've won.
President of the United States.
It's the students, Woodrow. They've come to serenade you. Will you go out to them?
Yes, my dear. Thank you. I have no feeling of triumph tonight. Only a sense of solemn responsibility. I know only too well the very great task ahead of me. And I look pleadingly to you, the young men of America, to stand behind me, to support me. That's all I can say except good night and God bless you.
Man of destiny in the White House, and in a single year, more social progress than any 10 men had achieved before him. The Federal Reserve Bank, the 8-hour law, the Antitrust Act, the Underwood Tariff. America's rich and prosperous. Too busy to worry about the rest of the world. Too busy laughing at Tilly's punctured romance. Too busy weeping over Daddy Longlegs. Too busy doing the bunny hug, the grizzly bear. Yes, everybody's doing it. Doing what? The turkey trot. But in the White House, the president is gaunt and haggard with worry. Mrs. Wilson, his beloved Ellen, lies desperately ill. Weeks of anxious vigil. Then... grief in the White House. A great bow of heavy black crepe on the door. And now to the stricken president comes still another sorrow. Newsboys call extras and sell their papers like hotcakes. Mr. John Citizen starts to get mad. And in the White House...
Mr. President, these sons must be taught a lesson.
Congress is all set to act. Back us up in a minute.
Mr. President, do you know what Lodge and his crowd are saying openly? That this administration lacks courage.
They may call me a coward or anything else they wish. I won't be rushed into this war.
Does that mean you're going to overlook the most dastardly crime of which any civilized nation has ever been guilty?
No. I shall warn the German government, in the strongest terms of which I am capable, that in the future it will be held to strict accountability.
Another note, Mr. President?
Yes, another note. Gentlemen, it would be the easiest thing in the world for me, as president, to ask for a declaration of war. The man on horseback is always a hero. But I wouldn't have to do the fighting. Some poor young boy would have to do the fighting and the dying. And when I ask him to do that, I want to be very sure that what he's dying for is worthwhile.
Brave, anxious days for the man in the White House while Europe is writing its story in blood. A troubled summer, a bitter winter, a worried spring. And then at last, the lonely man finds a measure of escape, of comfort and of happiness. More and more often, he's seen with lovely Edith Gault. Washington tongues are beginning to wag. And on a warm evening late in summer, seated on the White House portico looking out across the moon-drenched lawn.
I think this is my favorite spot at the White House.
It is lovely.
I asked the girls to leave us alone for a while, so I might have an opportunity to say something to you.
Yes?
I need you, Edith. Will you be my wife?
President.
I know this comes as a shock to you. Perhaps I've been too impulsive. But if I'm to continue to make opportunities to see you, I must speak.
But, Mr. President, how can you be sure? You've known me only a few months.
Time isn't always measured in weeks or months. In this last year, I've lived a lifetime of loneliness and heartache. You've changed all that, given me hope that happiness is still possible.
Have you spoken to your daughter?
Yes, they tell me they already love and admire you, and that nothing could make them happier.
But I've never thought of you except as the president. And besides, I've had no training for the responsibilities of such a life.
Would you rather I'd not spoken?
Oh, no. Any woman would be touched to be told that you could be of help to one in your position in times like these. But I must have time to see you, to know you, to be with you.
You want to see me?
Yes, I do.
Then I'll wait and hope. You will give me at least the right to hope.
Mr. President, I'd be less than a woman if I didn't.
Hope fulfilled. A White House wedding, brilliant and spectacular. And now another election, another campaign. The race this time between Wilson and Hughes. Political orators shouting wild charges. Wilson, they scream, is incompetent. A vacillating, insincere, and cowardly leader. And the answer comes back.
He kept us out of war.
This demagogue must be driven from control, from all influence upon the governments of the United States.
He kept us out of war.
Wilson is a blundering, starry-eyed idealist trying to create a dream world.
He kept us out of war.
November, the election won. The man in the White House charged with cowardice still standing valiantly by his guns until late of a rainy night in January.
President retired.
Yes, sir.
Wake have. Him, please. Tell him that Mr. Lansing, Secretary of State, and Count von Bernstorff, the German ambassador, are here. We must see him at once. Mr. President, I'm sorry to disturb you at such an hour, but Count von Bernstorff has just handed me another note from his government.
Yes?
Beginning tomorrow, Germany will resume its policy of unrestricted submarine warfare.
We have no other choice.
And we'll sink on sight. And without warning, any neutral vessel entering European waters.
With certain exceptions, of course.
Yes. I believe an American ship will be permitted to sail from a designated port each week, provided it is properly lighted and marked.
Mr. President, we deeply regret the necessity of this decision, and we sincerely hope it will not interfere with your noble efforts to bring peace.
Sit down, sir.
We also have now indisputable proof that the German government has been using our own State Department cables to foment trouble between this country and Mexico.
What?
With California, New Mexico, and parts of Texas as bait.
I deny any such thing, Mr. President.
The proof is overwhelming. There can be no doubt.
Mr. President.
Captain Vanstone, for more than 2 years, this government has exercised every restraint in its efforts to remain neutral in this conflict. But you and your military masters are apparently determined to deny us that right.
But I assure you,
every way we turn, we run into a blank wall of German cruelty and stupidity. Every time we think we've escaped, you blindly and deliberately block us with some new outrage.
Mr. President...
Won't you Germans ever be civilized? Won't you ever learn to keep your word or to regard other peoples as men, women, and children of flesh and blood like yourselves and not as inferiors to be treated as you see fit? All in the name of your discredited German culture and race superiority.
I wish to withdraw.
We are not exactly fools. We know about the spies and conspirators you've sent amongst us and of your ceaseless attempts to sabotage our industries and commerce.
I beg
you. Unfortunately, some of our own people have fallen in with your plans. And day after day, I see them going up and down this country, doing your work, crying out in their innocence, "This is just another European war. It can't touch America." Building up false illusions of safety and security, appealing to our ancient traditions of isolation, while you smile behind their backs and go right ahead with your evil plans to conquer and exploit the world.
I bid you good night, Mr.
You
President.
Will wait until I have concluded, Count von Bernstorff. Is your Kaiser so contemptuous of American military prowess? Does he think we're so weak and disunited just because we prefer peace to war that we will not fight in any circumstance? Or is he so drunk with power that he can't understand that such action will unite this nation as never before in its history? And that he has made it clear at last that this is, in truth, a fight for freedom and decency against the most evil and autocratic power the world has ever seen? Mr. Lansing, you'll hand Count von Bernstorff his passports immediately.
America at war. Rookies drilling, soldiers marching.
General Pershing, I give you only one order. Attack and attack and attack.
America mobilizing the home front, pouring steel, launching great ships. America overseas, in France. Young men by the thousands gone already, thousands more preparing to go. Then a Red Cross canteen at an embarkation point near Washington.
Would you like some coffee, soldier? Well?
Say, they've been trying to tell me you're the president's wife.
Oh, and you don't think I look the part?
I'll say not.
Perhaps you'd like to speak to the president about it.
The president? Where?
Right there, in an apron.
The president in a...
Cups are slippery, aren't they?
But you're the...
In this war, even the president has to do KP occasionally.
Hey, fellas! Hey, the president! Look, hey!
Hi, Mr. President.
Boy, wait till I write home about this.
I don't say we're just lying.
Where are you from, young man?
Milwaukee, sir.
German?
My father was German. I'm just an American.
And you?
My name is Vespucci, Mr. President, but I'm just an American, too.
I guess there's something funny about all of us, Mr. President. Now, Mike yonder here, he's a bohunk. Me? Well, I'm just Irish. Tex here claims he's just from plain Texas.
Oh, at least there ain't nobody told me any different yet.
This is all very interesting, boys. I want you to remember it. We are men of all races, with different backgrounds and ancestries, working together for a common purpose. That's what's made America what it is, and that's what's going to make the whole world a decent place to live in someday. If anyone tries to tell you that universal peace is just an idle dream, tell him he's a liar. Say your president said that you're fighting this war so there won't have to be any more wars. And that when we get through with it, we're going to sit down with the people of other countries
and work out some plans which will make it unnecessary for boys like you and your sons to have to go out and shoot one another. Maybe we'll call it a League of Nations. Maybe we'll call it something else. But whatever it is, that's what you boys are going to France for. And with the help of God, that's what you're going to get.
At last, the armistice. The war is done. But for the man in the White House, it's just the beginning. Now he must make good his promise to those boys. Off to Europe, to France, to be greeted as the savior of the world. To the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles with his precious dream of great world league. And finally, back to America again, to face the most serious opposition at home, a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Gentlemen, I asked you here in the hope that we might come to some understanding about the League of Nations.
Mr. President, I don't mean to be facetious, but whose understanding? Yours or ours?
One we can mutually uphold, Mr. Lodge. I'm sure we all have one purpose in common. To serve the best interests of the American people.
But apparently very different ideas as to what constitutes their best interests. The treaty would have been approved by the Senate weeks ago if it weren't attached to your league.
Not my league, Senator. I didn't originate it. As a matter of fact, I seem to recall that in 1915, you yourself advanced the thought that the nations would have to unite for peace.
But in my wildest dreams, I never contemplated pledging American arms on economic sanctions every time some ambitious ruler in Europe covets the lands and resources of another. We'd be constantly embroiled in quarrels that are none of our business.
Yet, let me remind you that in every discussion of the peace during the war, we promised the world...
I beg your pardon. You promised.
This government promised that some way would be found to avoid such catastrophes as we have just been through. Senator Lodge, perhaps we've made mistakes, all of us. But the League is the only hope the world has to avoid wars in the future. Unless you can advance a better idea, I beg of you to consider that and to help save that hope.
Mr. President, I too have my ideals, and one of them is peace. But a realistic peace that we can surely maintain on our own continent. And that, I suggest, is the only kind of peace the American people want.
America has but two choices, gentlemen. It must accept the League of Nations, or it must live with a gun in its hand. It's for the people to decide. Thank you for coming here. Good day.
Woodrow, how did it go?
I'll have no more haggling with that man. I'll stump the country and let the people know exactly what's at stake.
But your health... Dr. Gray,
I promised the young men of this country we were fighting this war to end war.
Woodrow, for my sake, why don't you do what they ask and get this awful quarrel settled?
Edith, don't you desert me too. I couldn't stand that.
Oh, my dear. I was only thinking of you and of your health. Forgive me, Woodrow. I should have known. I'll have Tumulty arrange for the tour at once.
Fighting president, a man of destiny, battling against illness and mobbing strain, takes his case to the highest court in the land, the people.
A war in which civilization has been fled twice must not end in a mere victory of arms and a new balance of power. We must not, we cannot stop short of our goal.
But everywhere he speaks, the opposition follows.
The question is, do you want American boys to police the world?
do you want American blood to uphold, maintain, and preserve old world government?
No! No! The isolation of the United States is at an end. We have become a determining factor in the world.
God gave us two oceans. Who's going to be foolish enough to attack us?
Columbus, Ohio, Richmond, Indiana, St. Louis, Missouri, Seattle, San Francisco, San Diego. 40 speeches in 22 days. The hand of destiny weighs heavy on him now. His shoulders sag. His voice is almost gone. And finally at Pueblo, speaking from the platform of his train.
I feel like asking the Secretary of War to get the boys who went across the water to fight. Together, on some field where I could stand up before them and say, boys, I told you before you went across the sea that this was a war against wars. And I did my best to fulfill the promise. But I am obliged to come to you in mortification and shame and say I have not been able to fulfill the promise. You are betrayed. You fought for something that you did not get. And the glory of the armies and the navies of the United States is gone like a dream in the night. And there ensues upon it, in the nightmare of dread which lay upon the nations before this war came. And there will come, sometime, in the vengeful providence of God, another struggle in which not a few hundred thousand fine men from America will have to die, but as many millions as are necessary to accomplish the final freedom of the peoples of the world. I...
Woodrow.
I thank you all for coming.
Take my arm, Woodrow. We're going inside.
Edith, I'm so tired.
It's all over now. Mr. Tumulty, will you please inform the newspaper men? We're returning to Washington at once.
All the rest is history, too. The people have their chance at the polls and repudiate the League. And with it, all that destiny has promised through the dream of this one man. It's all over now. But is it? Is it really over? Then listen to this final word.
Woodrow, what do you think will happen now? Can we ever hope for peace without the League?
Yes, Edith. The fight's just begun. The ideals of the League are not dead just because a few obstructive men now in the saddle say they are. The dream of a world united against war is too deeply embedded in the hearts of men everywhere. And I'll even make this confession to Providence. It may come about in a better way than we propose.
This is Glenn Riggs saying goodbye until next week, when we take you on another tour of your Radio Hall of Fame. This is the Blue Network.